Central to the practice of yoga is the concept of transformation. Noted yoga master BKS Iyengar has said that, quote, "Yoga does not just change the way we see things, it transforms the person who sees." It's been said that this concept of transformation in yoga is not so much about simply becoming a better person. It's about removing the obstacles that obscure who you really are so you can more fully express your true self. By becoming a certified yoga instructor with a transformation yoga project, John Brookins has been able to remove the obstacles in his life and the lives of other inmates, allowing him to find freedom despite being locked up.
Transformation yoga, and I always wanted to know what yoga practice. And then once that started, he was able to teach guys in institution and have retreats and just learn everything on a different level. Just living in that mind and body moment and learning to be present and learning how to breathe properly and learning the actual yoga routines. That was one of the things that really can really set your mind at peace.
And yet, at the same time, a different type of transformation might end up keeping John Brookins behind bars. John Brookins has filed for DNA testing that could finally and definitively prove who killed Sheila Ginsburg. But the state is pushing back against such testing, claiming that it couldn't prove his innocence. The defense, however, has argued that the state's position is a fundamental and untenable transformation of what it argued at trial.
Hi, and welcome to Undisclosed, the State versus John Brookins. This is the fourth episode in a four-episode series about the case of John Brookins, who we believe was wrongfully convicted of the 30-year-old murder of Sheila Ginsburg. My name is Robbie H. Audrey. I'm an attorney and author of the New York Times bestseller, A Non-Story. And as always, I'm joined by my co-hosts Susan Simpson and Colin Miller.
Hi, this is Susan Simpson. I'm an attorney in Washington, D.C., and I blog at The View from LL2.
Hi, this is Colin Miller. I'm an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog.
At the end of episode 3, we introduced a curveball into the investigation and prosecution of John Brookins for the murder of Sheila Ginsburg. This curveball was the reason why the Bristol police were apparently ignoring significant evidence that Sharon Ginsburg had murdered her mother, Sheila.
He's like, nah, that didn't happen. Eastlake don't want one of his girls to go to jail for killing the mother.
That's right. The hidden secret in Bristol was that Detective Al Eastlack was running a prostitution ring that included Sharon Ginsburg, and he turned a blind eye to her as a suspect in Sheila's killing to prevent his enterprise from being exposed. But he apparently didn't just turn a blind eye. Recall what was relayed by Kathy Rollins, who said she saw Sharon with bloody hands at dusk in the parking lot of her mother's building on the day she was murdered.
Because I was told to put a zip on my lip if I wanted to see my kids again. If I wanted to keep my babies, I better keep a zip on my lip. So I wouldn't talk to nobody. I'm kind of fidgety about talking to you about it.
And who told you to put a zip on your lip?
Eastlack.
Indeed, Kathy was so freaked out by the intimidation that she says she received from Eastlack, including threats to take away her children, that she decided she needed to make herself scarce.
What I did is I chopped up all my furniture because I didn't want nobody knowing. I just skipped town and moved to Virginia.
But unlike Kathy Rollins, not everyone had the ability to get the you-know-what out of Dodge, including someone who is critical to the case.
And let me ask you about that, because I know you had a first attorney in your case, and then you ended up having a change of attorney. Can you explain to me what happened with that first attorney you had?
Calico.
Uh-huh.
Lawrence Calico. It was one day we was in the interview room and inside Brooks County Prison. And then I guess the women's line was making line movement. And then the girls was coming off the block. Sharon was over there. I didn't know Sharon was over there. So she came off the block. Then she see me in the interview room, and then she started going into one of her spasm acts and whatnot, not saying anything, just all of a sudden hollering and screaming. And then Calical said he has to live here. He can't do this. And then after that, that's when Mark Ripples took over the case shortly thereafter.
Mm-hmm.
Because he never explained why he said he couldn't do this. He just blurted out and said, I can't do this.
And so John Brookins went from an attorney who had made his case his top priority to an attorney who he thought put his case on the back burner.
And they really only started the investigation, like, I think, like 30 days before the trial or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Ripples crew.
Next, to tie everything together, John Brookins said that his new attorney stood back as the detective scared some of East Lac's girls out of testifying.
Well, they knew I was talking to Barry Lynch, so they asked Barry Lynch, could I talk to my attorney to get the detectives off us? It was saying, because they were saying they're threatening the girls not to testify on my behalf. And I told them, they said, well, if they testify on my behalf, they could go to jail, get charges, you know, stuff like that. So I asked Mark Ripples about it. He was like, don't worry about it. So it sounded like he already knew about it, that these other potential witnesses that could have testified that was being threatened by these detectives out there, which was Potts, Harling, and Detective Eastlake.
Moreover, John Brookins claims that this threatening and intimidating behavior by the detectives was not limited to these potential witnesses, but was also on full display in their interactions with him.
Can you take me back? You had, I believe, three interactions with the detectives who questioned you about this case. Can you kind of go through the nature of those interactions and how they treated you when they were questioning you?
The first one, when they... they came to me, they always patted me down, displayed their weapons. It was always a pat down, empty my pockets, go in my pockets, put me up against the wall. Potts always put, wherever he came to Sharon's home, he always put his foot on a coffee table, and you know where his gun was on his ankle, Potts. And Harling would always pull his shirt back or jacket back, where his gun was on his hip, and it was like here, sit in the corner while they stand over me, and it was talking about they kept saying that they were scared of me. I said, for what? I'm not doing any harm towards y'all. I'm not doing any violence towards y'all.
John Brookins's first interaction with the detectives did not take place where one might expect.
Instead of taking me to the police station, which was like 2 minutes from Sharon's place, they took me the opposite direction down the road, like 15, 20 minutes down the road to the back of this building. Went through the back of this building to the Justice of the Peace, I guess. And matter of fact, it's the same Justice of the Peace office that I used to clean when I was a kid, because that's one of the places my father had as part of our business as far as part of the cleaning aspect.
And so, with this first interrogation being both off book and off site, John Brookins claims that the detectives engaged in some unorthodox behavior.
And then that's when Potts started walking up and down the office with a huge pair of scissors, open and closing back and forth, open and closing them, back and forth, just open and closing them. And then he started talking about confess, confess, confess. And at that time, that's when I had took them. I was up for a couple of days. I took the Xanax and drunk the beer because I was up for a couple of days. And I explained that to Rudy Harlan before I jumped in the car. And so he was smacking me in the back of the head, pat me on back, hit me on the back of the hand. Then Pops got a pen and a paper was saying, write down your confession. I said, confession? He said, write down your confession. So stay awake, stay awake. So he left the room. So as they leave the room, I'm in the room nodding. But they got the door cracked. But Rudy's leaning on the door where you can actually see him. So he kept yelling, open the door, yelling and screaming, telling me to wake up. And going back out, they was out there talking. And then once they got there talking, we went back in the car. And I fell asleep in the back of the car. And he kept screaming at me, talking about, we can drive you off anywhere, you keep falling asleep.
These allegations by John of the detectives hitting him and physically trying to force him to sign a confession while he was intoxicated are very similar to the allegations made by Willie Veazey, another Pennsylvania man whose case we covered in a previous series and who was exonerated last year. But unlike Willie Veazey, John would not sign a confession during this first interrogation, nor during a second interrogation, nor during a third interrogation after he was arrested. But according to John, his failure to sign a confession was not due to any lack of effort by the detectives. Let's start by going back to the day that John was arrested in a bedroom.
So, Eastlack pulls out this gun and throws it on top of the bed. Then as he throws the gun on top of the bed, Potts pushes me towards the gun on the bed. So as he pushed me, I took one like a step forward, and then I took a step slowly, was taking a step backwards. As I was taking a step backwards, here comes Viola Jackson coming down the hallway talking loud, cussing, like, what the hell is going on back here? And then as she was coming, it was like, grab him, pull his pants down. They pulled my pants down, and somebody said, where's the cuffs? Then they cuffed me. They threw me on. They pushed me on top of the bed, on top of the gun, and then cuffed me. So I'm assuming that's when Viola walked down, they pushed me on top of the gun to actually cover the gun. Because it was a big, giant, king-sized bed there. Then they cuffed me. They pulled my pants down and then took me out. And then as we're going back to the police station, Detective Eastlack is the one that was driving me back. Now, I'm thinking of what I just experienced. I'm not going to make it back there.
Mm-hmm.
So he's cussing, slobbering and spitting on talking about how he want to kill me. He want to effing kill me. He want to blow my brains out, this, that, and the other.
And then there were the threats that John claims that Detective Harling made regarding John's family and his girlfriend, Aretha Green, to try and coerce a confession from him.
You didn't see anything in the house. In Sheila's apartment. I said, yes, I seen Sharon in there. He was like, no, what about your family down in Bristolboro? We can make something happen to them. And he was talking about harming my mother, my sisters and brother. And he said, something can happen to a Rika. He said, something can happen to Aretha Green's kids at the same time, Brock and Xavier.
Mm-hmm.
And they wanted me to say that I covered their head. I covered Sheila's head with the Afghan. And said, when asked, they wanted me to say that I covered her head. And I didn't see anybody in the house that I found the body. But I didn't say anything.
According to John Brookins, when this didn't work out, the third detective made one last gasp effort to coerce his confession.
And then shortly thereafter, that's when Potts took me back to the holding cell. And as I'm in this holding cell, single way.
But John still didn't confess, and thus things didn't go away. As we noted previously, there were only two categories of evidence against John Brookins, other than that ridiculous fatal attraction motive that the prosecutor tried to concoct. While Sharon Ginsburg claimed that she eavesdropped on John confessing to the murder to a friend, the state didn't call her at trial. But they did call the detectives, who testified as to what John said and didn't say during these interviews. For instance, they would claim that John initially said he had not been in Sheila's apartment since October, when he was in a work release program. John, however, claims that he said that other than December 20th, the day Sheila was murdered, he hadn't been in Sheila's apartment since October. And the detectives would also claim that John never said that he'd come upon Sharon murdering her mother, while John insists that he did indeed tell them his story of being in the right place at the wrong time and seeing Sharon stab her mother. In the end, as you might have guessed, we can't know what happened, because none of John's three interviews were recorded, and there is no written documentation of what John did and did not say.
Conversely, the second category of evidence against John does have documentation, and arguably too much documentation for the state, the forensic evidence. As we previously previewed, this case comes down to three of John Brookins' fingerprints found in Sheila Ginsburg's apartment. One in the toilet seat, one in the phone, and one combined with Sheila's blood in the TV remote. The state claimed at trial that these three definitively proved John Brookins' guilt. John Brookins would counter that the one in the seat was based upon him using the toilet while helping Sheila clean, and the other two came from when he turned down the TV and started calling 911 after trying to help Sheila in the wake of Sharon stabbing her. But then, there's another key piece of forensic evidence that the jury never heard about. As we noted previously, in December 1990, Sharon was living with a man named Dan Lyden, whom she called her stepfather, and seeing another man named Paul Cotman, who was actually married to a woman named Lorraine. And according to Paul Cotman, he made a huge discovery in this case. Here's an excerpt from one of Detective Eastlack's police reports. Dan told Cotman that he, Dan, thinks that Sharon killed her mother and used a pair of red gloves, or something about these gloves being involved. Cotton was cleaning his car on March 18, 1991, and found a pair of red leather small gloves under the passenger car seat of his car, and left them in case something came up in this area. Cotton showed this writer and Sergeant Mills these red gloves, and Sergeant Mills took these gloves into evidence from this 1979 Oldsmobile. Sergeant Mills submitted the gloves into evidence. This police report is corroborated by a property receipt, which also notes that the gloves were collected. It's also corroborated by Paul Cotman's wife, Lorraine.
And I remember Al Eastlack and Tom Mills, detectives, had been notified that my husband found a pair of red gloves under the front seat of our car that were Sharon's. He took the gloves and wrapped them up, said he was taking them to the station. And under the impression, I was told, those gloves never reappeared anywhere.
So what happened to those gloves? Well, at the time of John Brookins' trial, they hadn't been tested, and according to John, he wouldn't even find out they existed until almost a decade later. At what point did you become aware that Paul Cotman had found gloves and what he thought were bloody gloves in his car?
I believe it had to have been during the course of when I got the discovery, I believe.
Okay. So this would have been pre-trial you learned about the gloves.
No, that would have been 1999 when I got discovery.
Oh, so you weren't aware of the gloves until after you'd already been convicted and you were getting these documents after the fact.
Yes.
Okay. Upon learning about these gloves, John, of course, immediately moved for DNA testing, and that motion was granted. But then, things inextricably went awry. I spoke with John's attorney, Craig Cooley, about what went down.
John tried to get the testing on those back all the way at the turn of the millennium, but his appointed attorneys out of Bucks County just really didn't do anything. And I fleshed that out in the opening brief of the Superior Court. So it sat there for nearly 10 years, and he finally got a hearing in 2010 on this limited DNA motion focusing on the gloves. The PCRA court initially granted testing because the DA's office never thought an answer to John's motion. And then there's some sort of hearing where the DA's office goes in and says, look, give us more time, we will respond, even though it's very late. And next thing you know, the judge withdraws the order granting testing on the gloves.
What's the explanation they gave for not granting that testing?
That's the problem. She just entered an order and said it wouldn't prove his innocence. And under DNA testing, and under the DNA testing statute, yeah, the DNA results have to prove the petitioner's actual innocence.
Mm-hmm.
It's difficult to fathom how the judge could have come to this conclusion because the case for actual innocence seems straightforward. If testing on the inside of the glove returned a DNA profile, in other words, wearer DNA, that was a match for Sharon, and testing on the outside of the glove returned a DNA profile or a blood profile that was a match for Sheila, that would seem to prove Sharon's guilt and John's innocence. Now, in fairness, you might question whether there is enough evidence tying Sharon to the gloves to grant testing. Well, in addition to seeking DNA testing, John brought a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel against his trial attorney based upon his failure to call Paul Cotman at trial. This led to Paul testifying on a number of matters. First, he testified that Sharon was addicted to crack and wanted money from her mother around the time of Sheila's murder. Second, he said he was with Sharon when she left her place on December 21st, 1990, to go to her mother's place, and that she was wearing different clothes when she returned, red jeans and sneakers versus blue jeans and boots. Third, he said he felt crack vials in Sharon's jean pockets on the night that Sheila was murdered, which is consistent with Gay Gilliard's testimony that she sold Sharon crack that night. Fourth and finally, he said that the only people who had been in his car between the murder and his discovery were himself, his wife, and Sharon, with the gloves found in the car being very small. And while Paul testified that Sharon had small, petite hands, he said that his wife had, well, as immortalized in a famous Seinfeld episode,
man hands?
The hands of a man.
Indeed, when Paul showed the gloves to his wife, Lorraine, she responded, quote, they must have been your little whores. And Paul would also testify that he thought he'd seen Sharon with the gloves before, and that he'd never seen his wife with gloves. Paul concluded that Sharon had used the gloves to kill her mother and then planted them in his car to frame him. Now, overall, even if we assume the defense counsel was unaware about these gloves at the time of trial, Paul Cotman seems to have been a valuable witness who could have testified about Sharon's motive and opportunity to commit the crime. As such, why did the judge deny John's claim of ineffective assistance of counsel? Well, the judge adopted the argument in the state's briefing that Paul Cotman said that John Brookins was violent and had injured Sharon. But here's the thing. Paul Cotman did not give such testimony at the ineffective assistance hearing. Instead, he testified that, quote, I don't remember Sharon saying that Brookins physically injured her, and I don't remember Sharon saying anything about Brookins being violent. Moreover, we've gone through each of Paul Cotman's statements in the case files, and there's not a single thing about John Brookins being violent at all. And John's attorney, Craig Cooley, says the same thing.
The other question I have is, looking at the appellate opinions when they talk about trial counsel not calling Paul Cotman, The main justification that seems to be given is that Paul Kottman allegedly says at one point that John was abusive toward Sharon. But I don't see that in any of Paul's police statements. Is there any actual documentation where Paul says that John was abusive toward Sharon?
I have not seen that.
Uh-huh.
No, not that I'm aware of.
In fact, any witness you can find says that John Brookins was a gentle giant. And that even includes people who didn't know him all that well, including Lorraine Kottman.
Johnny wouldn't have killed nobody. John was not that type of person. John would bend over backwards for somebody and was one of the greatest guys I know. He went to church. He was very good in church people and his family. I know his family, and they're all good people. And I can't understand why somebody would think John had the power to do this.
Conversely, there are countless witnesses who have said the exact opposite about Sharon Ginsburg. For instance, in his testimony, Paul Kottman testified that Sharon threatened his then-wife Lorraine with a lawnmower blade, a story which Lorraine corroborates.
She used to threaten me herself. She came down to my apartment, stood outside my door, and when I went downstairs, she came after me with a lawnmower blade. She was going to kill me. I know my husband had to either drive me to work himself, or else he took me down to Green Lane and Route 13 and waited for me to get the bus to go to work because Sharon threatened to come after me.
And this violence was not limited to any one person. Sharon's unofficial grandfather said that he saw Sharon go after a neighbor with a pipe and went after another guy with a knife when he was inspecting her house. Melina Halleck, one of the sex workers at the Ballpark Tavern, who we mentioned last episode, said that Sharon swung a butcher knife at her, but that she was able to duck before being saved by a couple guys who pulled Sharon away. Finally, members of Sharon's family were not immune from this violence, including her son, Ricky.
She hit him upside the head with a frying pan in the back of her neck. Had blood in one of his eyes. That's why you have to wear the glass. That's why it's the way you do now, because she hit him in the head at a very young age. Very young age. And definitely took his sight from him.
And then there was Sharon's brother, Barry, who said that during Christmas in 1988, Sharon went after him with a knife. And yes, multiple witnesses also said that Sharon committed acts of violence against her mother, Sheila. This was said, for instance, by her good friend Agnes, who recounted an incident on Christmas Eve 1989 when Sharon took a knife to her mother. But even given this background, what would have been the spark that could have ignited the powder keg? In a prior episode, we noted that Sheila had been holding money for Sharon, who desperately wanted it to buy drugs. But according to John, it was more than just that.
Do you have a sense of why she wanted to kill her mother?
Yeah, she was. She was holding money back for her, because she didn't want to. She was like, "Listen, we're not gonna. Me and Barry is not gonna spend money on you. You have to make an effort to save some money. Give me some money every month." And at the same time, she knew that Sheila was moving to Florida. I was going to New York for a new job, and we were all celebrating everyone's good fortune. And she felt that everyone was leaving her. And that was one of the things that she was saying when I was talking to her in front of my brother's house early that morning. She felt that everyone was leaving her, and I was like, you didn't have to react, like, because every time she reacts with something, it's always explosive. It's just, you know, explode now and then think about it later.
And John also has a theory for why Sharon would have stabbed her mother in the chest.
So Sharon, there should be a time where she was very proud of this, but she showed me where her mother had stabbed her. It's like right under breast, like on her, off the ribcage area. It's an obvious mark.
This takes us to the present status of John's case. He's asked for DNA testing of some of the 50-plus pieces of evidence collected from the crime scene, as well as the gloves found in Paul Cotman's car. This includes testing of Sheila's bra, which was found pushed up, the trophy that was likely used to knock her unconscious, Sheila's fingernail scrapings, Sheila's purse, which her killer might have combed through for cash, the scissors found embedded in Sheila's chest, and a second pair of scissors found under the coffee table. And with regard to the second pair of scissors, we have one final witness in this case. Her name is Elaine Newkirk. She didn't testify at trial, and she's now deceased. But she did give a statement in 1992, before she died, in which she recalled speaking to Sharon about the crime. According to Elaine, Sharon told her that the articles in the newspaper were wrong, because there were two pairs of scissors, not one. One with a black handle, and one with a blue handle. So it seems straightforward that DNA testing could prove John's innocence, and he's not the only one currently making this type of argument.
My brother Purvis Payne is scheduled to die this year, December the 3rd, for a crime he did not commit. DNA testing could prove his innocence.
That's from our friends at the Innocence Project, who are working on the strikingly similar case of Purvis Payne. Payne, an African-American man, says he was going to see his girlfriend at her apartment building in Tennessee when he discovered that her Caucasian neighbor, Cherise Christopher, and her children had been brutally attacked. Payne says he tried to help before becoming afraid he'd be mistaken for the killer and running. With his execution scheduled for December 3rd, the Innocence Project and his attorneys moved for DNA testing of crime scene evidence, but the state responded that there was clear forensic evidence placing him at the crime scene, meaning the testing couldn't prove his actual innocence. However, with an execution looming, a judge recently granted DNA testing, and we're working with the Innocence Project in a request to the Tennessee governor for clemency that we'll discuss in more detail in the addendum. But back to John Brookins, and back to the introduction to this episode. What is the transformation of the state's argument to which we alluded? John Brookins' attorney, Craig Cooley, breaks down the state's theory of the case at trial in his DNA petition as follows. First, in 2,000-plus pages of trial transcripts and in nearly 30 years of pleadings, not once has the district attorney's office ever argued or remotely suggested Sharon Ginsburg participated in Sheila's murder. In fact, during the punishment phase and sentencing hearings, the district attorney's office told jurors Sharon was an innocent victim in two ways. One, she had to sit through Mr. Brookins' murder trial and listen to the details of her mother's horrific murder. And two, although innocent of Sheila's murder, Mr. Brookins and others falsely accused her of murdering Sheila.
As in the Purvis Payne case, however, the state in the John Brookins case is opposing DNA testing by claiming that it could not prove John's actual innocence. And they're doing so by making the argument that the evidence at trial was susceptible to the alternate theory that John and Sharon could have committed the crime together, meaning that any DNA results that implicate Sharon also implicate John. This seems facially ridiculous, given that the defense's whole theory at trial was that Sharon murdered her mother and that the state did everything to argue that she was an innocent and grieving daughter. But DNA motions have been denied based on less, and it's not clear at this point whether John Brookins will ever get the testing that could prove his innocence. But, as his attorney notes, while actual innocence is a requirement to get DNA testing, if that testing is authorized, it would take something less for John to secure a new trial.
They say we do DNA testing. That doesn't mean we're going to get crystal clear results, but if we get, like, Sharon's DNA on the bra, so all we have to do is articulate a theory, and if that can prove John's innocence. That doesn't mean we're going to actually get those results. I'm hoping you do. And there's a shot, you know, the DNA cases. There have been a number of redundancy cases where you get the same DNA profile, and if that profile doesn't hit to somebody in CODIS, you can still make the argument, like, what is the likelihood of this person's DNA being on each of these incriminating items of evidence?
Right. Okay?
But say we do testing, and it doesn't work out that way. Say we simply have, like, Sharon's DNA on the scissors. Well, now under the statute, that's a new fact. The actual innocence standard is only for testing. So if we get testing and we only develop, like, Sharon's DNA on the bra or the scissors, that's still a new fact. you go in, the argument would be probably had John Brooken had this one piece of evidence to say Sharon's DNA is on those scissors. Oh, which, by the way, were stuck in Sheila's chest.
Right.
Right? That undermines confidence. It's reasonably probable, had the jury known that, that fact alone would have added credibility to all these other women who said that Sharon confessed, and he's entitled to a new trial. So, point being is, we don't have to prove actual innocence to get a new trial. We simply have to articulate a theory that will get us testing, and then that's why I want to see what testing can do.
To support this DNA motion, Craig Cooley went down to Florida with his private investigator to look for Sharon Ginsburg so that they could get her DNA profile.
So we went to the first address we had for Sharon, to the property complex in Fort Lauderdale. Paul and I get out of the car, and the apartment, visualize an apartment building, and you have to walk around the back to get to the apartments. The front of the apartment. So this is what we did. We're walking, and right at the corner of the apartment building, there's a woman smoking a cigarette, and she whistles at me. She makes like a comment, like, wow, that's get with you. Somewhat funny. And so Paul and I keep walking past her, and I said, Paul, I think that's her.
To confirm his suspicion, Craig went back to the car to check the photo they had of Sharon.
We go back to the car, and I pull up a photo that I had of her. And I'm like, that's her. So we went back. She was still smoking the cigarette and introduced ourselves. And it was an interesting conversation.
And that interesting conversation, of course, was about the murder of Sharon's mother, Sheila.
I made it clear to her I was John Brooks' attorney, and we just wanted to do DNA testing. And as I'm talking to her, I'm giving her a play-by-play of how I think the murder happened. Because I know, I mean, in my heart, I know Sharon. I have no doubt Sharon Ginsburg murdered her mother.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wanted to put that visual in her mind, get the reaction from her. And so I'm walking her through, we think the perpetrator struck Sheila first, disabled her. Then we think, Sheila kept money in her bra. Why the shirt was pushed up, this is why the bra was pushed up, and this is how, got a pair of scissors. So I'm getting this great visual. And she just locked eyes with me. No emotion whatsoever, right? She didn't murder your mom, and I'm literally giving you a visual of how I think your mom was murdered. I'm assuming
right.
You would show some sort of emotion, like, oh my God, it's terrible. She literally just would not. She locked eyes with me, and I was locking eyes with her, and I was trying to get some sort of emotional reaction.
Having presented his theory about how Sheila was killed, but not who killed her, Craig got to the point.
I said, look, we're here, we want to do DNA testing, and you're Sheila's daughter, and we want to eliminate you, and so would you give us a DNA sample? And honestly, now she's biracial. I've never seen a biracial woman turn ghost white so quickly. And her hands started visibly shaking. Because Paul was beside me, he's elbowing me in the back, making sure I see the shaking. And she stared at me for another minute, 2 minutes. And I'm locking eyes with her. And she says, first thing she says is I didn't kill my mother. I said, Sharon, I didn't say you killed your mother. I just said, I need a DNA sample to eliminate you as a potential donor that somebody might be in the apartment. She's like, well, I didn't kill my mother. I'm like, Sharon, I didn't say you killed your mother. So she locks eyes with me for another minute, still visibly shaking. And she's like, okay, you can have my DNA.
Unfortunately, Craig had run into Sharon before he'd expected, so he had to go out and get a DNA test.
Great. We'll come back tomorrow. And me and Paul were just real quick. It's a big swab. Just put it in. It's okay. So Paul and I go back to the hotel. And we both knew what we just witnessed.
Mm-hmm. And so we go, there's a Walgreens right down, like 2 blocks from our hotel in Fort Lauderdale. Buy an $80 DNA kit, which is basically a big-ass Q-tip for $80. And we go back to Sharon's apartment. We knock, and it's empty. No one's there. I'm like, oh, man. So we went back again in the afternoon, same thing. Went back again at night, same thing. So no one ever answered it. So it's like, oh, she's dodging us.
And so DNA testing is still a question mark at this point. John Brookins desperately wants DNA testing that could prove his innocence, while the state is adamant that no amount of testing will change its belief that he was complicit in this crime.
But while one arm of the state is fighting against John's release, another arm is struggling to secure it. There's a body in Pennsylvania known as the Board of Pardons, and it has 5 voting members. Traditionally, the body has existed to grant early release to people like juvenile lifers and other inmates who appear rehabilitated. Recently, Pennsylvania Lieutenant Governor John Fetterman has done 2 things with this board. First, he hired George Trudell and Naomi Blount, 2 people who had their sentences commuted, to assist in reviewing commutation applications. And 2, he sought to expand the board's purview to include wrongful convictions to help Pennsylvanians who are not covered by Larry Krasner's Conviction Integrity Unit in Philadelphia. And luckily for John Brookins, these 2 things coalesce perfectly with his case. Here's John's wife, Karen, who got a call from the lieutenant governor late last year.
He talked to me and said, a sense of urgency, you know, in the voice. He was like, I'd like to know if you can talk to John and let him know that I want to use him to be the first wrongful conviction pardon in the state of Pennsylvania. And he said it won't hurt him. None of this will hurt him. He basically said there's unlimited resources of investigation and that kind of thing. Like, they would research anything that they needed to about his case. And then he brought up the fact that at Buck's case, he said he read enough to feel that John's innocent. It doesn't belong there. Mm-hmm. And then he also shared that George Trudell, who is now on the pardon, you know, as a pardon specialist, or I'm sorry, commutation specialist there in Pennsylvania, he said that George was instituted with John, and George spoke highly of John, and it's one of the reasons why he wants to use John, you know, have John's case.
Unfortunately, John's hearing before the Board of Pardons was supposed to take place just as COVID hit, so it's now been delayed until the end of 2020 or possibly even early 2021. And it's not clear if all members of the Board of Pardons view the body as one that should be tackling wrongful convictions in the first place. And it would take a 5-0 vote to get relief, although there are currently proposals that would allow for a 4-1 or 3-2 vote. And what that means is that John Brookins is currently much in the same state of limbo that he's been in for the past 30 years. For John, it's been a difficult journey, and his conviction had an immediate and visceral impact on him.
So let me ask you, what has it been like being in prison all these years for a crime that you know you didn't commit? What effect has that had on you?
I was suffering from these panic attacks, and I was getting this vertical where I would walk, because these graders for these tiers is like super long. And when I'm having these panic attacks, the tier is like moving. So I'm like, people have noticed, but I'm walking down the tier holding the railings. You know, trying to, you know, it's like an everyday thing. Every so often, I would have panic attacks, emotional attacks. It was like waking up every morning. Every morning, I would wake up with one eye open. It just seemed like it was a nightmare. You know, it's a dream. You know, when you go to sleep, everything is going to change. And then when you wake up, I wake up with one eye open, look around, still here.
Once John Brookins finally accepted the fact that this was his new normal, then, like so many other wrongfully convicted individuals, he began to dig into the law to see how he could right his wrong.
So the next thing was, all right, I need to learn more about my situation. So I started educating myself, went back to school. Then I had family and friends that was sending me money for, I started buying law books, trying to understand the process, even though I haven't had any of my information concerning my case. I was learning about doing law research, learning how to write a brief. Reading the material is very difficult. Learning to do legal work, that was one of the most difficult things I've ever done in my life.
Luckily for John, he wasn't alone in his quest to learn the law and fight for his freedom.
I was fortunate. I had met a guy here that had nothing to gain or nothing to lose. If I helped him, I said, listen, I don't want you to do anything for me. I got books. I just want me to show me how to do certain things. So he's like, anything that happened in your case, you have to start writing it down. I said, huh? He said, everything that happens, you have to write every step. So that was like towards the end. So I got my typewriter and started writing it down by hand. I started typing it up and step by step, everything that happened. And I was just fortunate that I had some good people around me to give me some direction.
Mm-hmm.
And I had loved ones that was willing to help me.
Right.
Find my way through this.
Additionally, as noted in the introduction, John has found peace through becoming a certified yoga instructor with the Transformation Yoga Project, through which he teaches yoga and meditation to fellow inmates, including those with cancer and MS, and those in the mental health block.
I was teaching yoga on the mental health block for the guys that's on medication and the MHU block. And some of the sites asked me to come over and teach a yoga for them. So one of the guys that came out, that done the practice, he said, because he was waiting a couple weeks just to see what the practice looked like. So he finally came out and got involved into the practice. Then when he got done with the practice, he was like, listen, man, I need that. He said, I seen you been coming over here for weeks, and I see the peace in the guys' minds and bodies afterwards, like throughout the day. And then I told myself, the next time you come over here, I'm going to jump into this practice. But he said, like, once he completed the practice, listening to the sound of my voice and going through the practice itself, and then the guided meditation, he was like, I needed that helped me get through this day. And then each time after that, when I showed up, I was always giving tips. I always give the guys tips when they go back to the cells about breathing, relaxing, about. And he was like, listen, this helped me so much. I said, yes, I'm with you. That's one of the reasons I do it. Not just for myself, but to help each guy that's in here. Because I know a lot of us is going home. So it's all about helping a person live to see the day they go home.
Right.
Because this place has so much stress.
Uh-huh.
So much anxiety.
So if John is released, what are his plans? If God willing, things go your way now and you are released after all these years, what would that mean to you, and what do you hope your life would look like on the outside?
It would mean everything. It would mean I would be able to live with my beautiful sexy wife, Karen. I would be able to help raise my grandchildren. I would be able to teach. I'm looking forward to coming back in and teaching yoga to the guys that's here and developing programs for people that's outside these walls. And is for individuals with MS, I believe that will work with individuals with MS and individuals with Parkinson's, because I work with a lot of individuals here with some of the training techniques I do, and I believe that I help them tremendously. And it would just be a beautiful thing being able to breathe the same air as my wife and to wake up each morning so we can share a day together, each day together.
Thanks so much for listening to this season of Undisclosed. We'll keep working on and reporting on John's case, and we'll be sure to let you know when his hearing is scheduled with the Board of Pardons so you can show your support. And while we're signing off for now, we'll be back in just 2 weeks with a brand new series, next time on Undisclosed. Thanks for listening to this episode of Undisclosed. I'd like to thank the following people: Rebecca Lavoie for audio production, Christy Williams for website management, Mital Telhan, our executive producer. As always, I'd like to thank our sponsors. You can support us at patreon.com/undisclosedpod, and you can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram using the handle @undisclosedpod.